Mishpatim, the Torah shifts, we would say, quite noticeably, quite decisively, from the narrative to the legislative. And we are in no uncertain terms in the world of mitzvahs, beginning with Mishpatim. And I wanted to begin by referencing a fascinating comment of the Sefer HaChinuch. And in fact, the Sefer HaChinuch here is not in Parshas Mishpatim, but in Parshas Shoftim, because the mitzvah to set up a Sanhedrin actually is explicit in Sefer Devarim. Shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha, to set up a Sanhedrin. And as we know, it is the way of the Sefer HaChinuch to discuss certain halachas of the mitzvah, the source of the mitzvah, and then give what he calls shorish ha-mitzvah, what we might loosely say the reason behind the mitzvah. And if you can read two lines of the Sefer HaChinuch, I think there's a great deal contained there. Shorish ha-mitzvah. What is the reason for this mitzvah of setting up a Sanhedrin, of having a legal system, a judicial system more correctly? She'im hadavar hazeh, because if we have a Sanhedrin, na'amid daseinu, we'll establish our law, v'hiyos emas alufeinu v'shofteinu apnei ha'amon, that the awe and fear of the judiciary will be on the masses. If there are consequences, they will be circumspect and careful and deterred from acting incorrectly. And then says the Sefer HaChinuch, umitoch hergelam batov uvayosher machmas yira, and the hope is that through accustoming themselves to act correctly out of fear, albeit out of fear of the consequences of the judiciary, yilmadu ha'amtiv am lasos mishpat v'tzedek me'av, they should come and and habituate themselves to do the right thing out of love. I believe what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying is most profound. Let us consider, if we would ask, why do you need a judiciary? Why do you need a punitive system? I think the answer, which is straightforward for us, is you need to protect society for the good of society. After all, people are at risk if there are no consequences, if there's no punishment. And while that is certainly true, the Chinuch is taking things one step further. The Sefer HaChinuch says, do you know why you need to have a Sanhedrin who will punish people if they do something wrong? The point is not just to save victims from would-be perpetrators. The point is to save would-be perpetrators from becoming actual perpetrators. In other words, the Sanhedrin, or the goal of having a Sanhedrin, is looking out for everyone. Not only to protect the victim, that they shouldn't be attacked, but to protect people from becoming attackers. That's the goal. Not to lose sight of the entire people. And I think it really is a hallmark, one could say, of the punishments of the Torah, that they don't forget about the perpetrator. And although he needs to be dealt with, but the goal is not that there should be no victims. The goal is that there should be no perpetrators. There should be no attackers. That's the ideal. It begins with a framework, but ultimately people should then naturally act in a way that's correct. We have as much of an eye on the aggressor that he should not be an aggressor. And then we do on the on the rest of society. I believe it's a really fascinating idea. And the truth is, not only in theory, in the realms of deterrence, do we have half an eye on the aggressor, but even when it comes to punishments, there is a fascinating Gemara, Rashi quotes it, and it relates to a pasuk in the end of Perikav Aleph. Perikav Aleph, pasuk Lamed Zayin, if you have the pasuk handy, I'll just read it. And it's a well-known halacha, ki yignov ish shor oseh. If a person steals an ox, a sheep, utavacho o mecharo, and he then slaughters it or sells it, so not only has he sold it, but then he's added further crimes. So as we know, if a person steals, he pays back double, what's called kefal. But if he not only steals, but then shechts the animal, so then he pays back more than double. Chamisha bakar yishalem tachas hashor. He pays back fivefold for the ox. Va'ar batzom tachas haseh. And four for a sheep. So these are additional payments. And the question is, if we're already there, if we're already adding on, why four for a sheep and five for an ox? I mean, once we're already in the additional zone, so we assume they should be the same. And Rashi says an unbelievable thing. Quoting Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Chas hamokom akvodim shabrios. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has compassion for his creations. Which creations? Let's see. Says Rashi, how do you steal a cow? How do you steal a sheep? Well, for those of us who don't know, Rashi enlightens us. You steal an ox by leading it out. To lead an ox through the street is a normal thing. Shor shaolech baraglav, the ox which is led out walking, v'lo nisbaza bo haganav lenosa oksefo, and the ganav did not undergo any degradation by having to carry it. So if there's crime with no degradation, you pay five. Seh, but a sheep, shenosa oksefo, he has to carry, nebuch. This poor ganav, yes, it's his. He's degraded for a living. Picture him, this poor. Your heart goes out to him. Hoven is bazabo, so he gets a discount. He gets a bizoyon discount. That is Rashi's explanation from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And it's truly baffling. We might think, after all, he's the criminal. So let him have his yonus. Magialo, as they say. And along comes Rashi and says, you know, if he had bizoyon, he gets a discount. Give him a break. Who would be thinking about the perpetrator's degradation at this time? After all, it's hardly elicits empathy. We say, it must have been so difficult for you. Carry, you know, you poor thing, carrying that sheep out. Don't steal it and don't carry it out. Earn a living. And yet the Torah says he is a criminal and he has to pay. But he's met with a certain level of understanding that degradation. And I believe perhaps, and one can never really generalize, and one can never oversimplify, but could it be that maybe the reason why he's stealing is because no one has ever shown him any regard. No one has ever shown any concern as to whether he's degraded. Perhaps it takes the Torah within the scope of the punishment to give some understanding to his dignity. Who knows? Who knows whether that might get him thinking that maybe he should also take his own dignity in hand and maybe support himself in dignity and not have to tunnel under houses and steal into farms and carry sheep all over the place. To be sure, the point is not to completely let him off punishment, and the victim's well-being comes first. That's not what we're saying. The victim gets compensated, but the perpetrator is also part of the picture. We never say, oh, we'll take your feelings into account you're covered into account, and therefore you won't be punished. Because, on the contrary, to completely let him off from punishment, I don't think there's any greater degradation than that. Because really what you're saying to him is, you have no accountability for your actions. There is no greater dismissal of a person than that. And therefore, we take him seriously. Actions have consequences, and crime meets punishment. And still, we say that there was a bizoyon for you. And maybe the Torah was the first place that anyone ever cared about his bizoyon. Indeed, this brings us later on in the Torah to a fascinating discussion. Parshas Ki Tzetze. As we know, there is the section of Malkus, of lashes, and sometimes if a person does an Avera, he's liable for lashes. How many lashes? That is the question. Well, the Torah says 40. Arba'im Yakenu, in Parshas Ki Tzetze. Along come the rabbis, and they say 39. It's based on a drasha. If you're familiar, the pasuk says, "B'mispar arba'im," the number of 40, the number leading to 40. And before you look around, 40 became 39. It's a well-known halach. Ask the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh. You know, Arba'im really does sound a lot like 40. I mean, between you and me, it really does sound like 40. With all due respect to B'mispar Arba'im, and there's a drasha, but how can we lose sight of the fact that the pasuk says explicitly 40? Can it be 40 and 39? Says Maharal, yes, it can. And here's why. How can it be 40 and 39? Because there's 40 parts to a person. We have the well-known idea that the critical assembly of the person takes place over 40 days. And the 40th day is his neshama. Now, that means you have 39 days that represent his physical existence. And then on day 40, his neshama. Says Maharal, you can't do an Avera without the collaboration of both body and soul. If the two don't go together, right, it takes two to, well, do an Avera. But the question is, who's at fault? Most Avera, says Maharal, it's the influence of the physical existence on the person. Now, it needs to be addressed, but how much of the person needs to be addressed? How many parts of the person committed the crime? 40. 40 out of 40. But should you ask how many of those 40 parts are at fault? The Torah says 39. Anyone who's in teaching, or those who teach younger children, certainly, they know that sometimes a group might be involved in some prank or misbehavior, but you can isolate the kids who are the ones that need to be punished and the ones who, they fell in with bad company. And it seems like discrimination, but it isn't. It's discernment of who needs to be punished and who just needs to be spoken to and maybe to be encouraged to be in better company. Says Maharal, you know why Averas happen? Because your soul falls into bad company. But your soul never needs to be punished. The 39 parts of the body, they need to be punished. And if they're chastised, the soul will be just fine. And therefore, says Maharal, when the Torah says 40 lashes, it is 40. It's the effect on all 40 parts of the person, but only 39 need to be actually lashed. Now, part number 40 is good to go. And once again, the idea that comes through here is that there is a certain fundamental endorsement of the person, of his fundamental worth. Even if a person has willingly, or willfully more correctly, violated a prohibition of the Torah and needs to be punished, we do not say all 40 out of your 40 parts are wrong and deserve Malkus. We say 39 need to be addressed. The 40th is good to go. That's you. Try better next time. Ironically, It could be that the person gets more of an endorsement and validation of his essential worth when he's punished by the Torah than when he's spoken to by most of his peers. And this all corroborates the idea that the idea of mishpatim from the outset, it is with as much an eye on the perpetrator that he shouldn't become a perpetrator. And if he does, he shouldn't continue. He shouldn't be a repeat offender. Is there anything that could be done for him? Not just, quote unquote, to protect the victims, although of course they always come. So these are some fascinating comments from all different parts, from Rashi and from the Sefer HaChinuch and from the Maharal, forming this most profound idea. Now we mentioned the mitzvah of setting up a Sanhedrin, and I must share with you a most fascinating discussion that takes place in one of the writings of Reuven Margolius. If the name is familiar, Reuven Margolius lived not too long ago, encyclopedic knowledge, absolute phenomenon. How many people are in a Sanhedrin? How many people are in a Beis Din? Well, as we know, there are three iterations or three variations. Your basic Beis Din is three, and then your regional Sanhedrin is 23. And the Sanhedria Gedola, the big Sanhedrin, is 70 or 71. And that's as far as it goes. And it's based on Psukim. Moshe was told to assemble 70 elders, and he's either number 70 or 71. That's as far as it goes. Says Reuven Margolius, would someone mind telling me how we ever came to have a group called the Anshei Knesset HaGadola? At the beginning of the Second Commonwealth, the beginning of the Second Beis HaMikdash, which comprised no less, as we know, than 120 members. Says Reuven Margolius, 120 is not on my radar. I mean, that's 50 too many. I've never heard of it. As we know, there are other bodies that are also comprised of 120 people, modeling themselves on the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. Would that there were other points of similarity as well. Hope springs eternal. But where does 120 come from? I've never heard of it. It's just, where does this number? And what's more, says the Reuven Margolius, if you think you've heard everything, wait for this. The Yerushalmi in Maseches Megillah, which discusses the institution of Purim, states that Purim was instituted by a Sanhedrin of 88 members. Now we've heard everything. The maximum is meant to be 70. You have Anshei Knesset HaGadola, who's 120. 88 came out of nowhere. I mean, what's behind these numbers? It's a very interesting shaila. In one of his many works, entitled Yesod HaMishnah V'Arichasa, Reuven Margolius explains wonderfully. The truth is that in principle, there should only be 70 members of Sanhedrin. And that's how it was from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, and the original 70 were chosen by Moshe. Now, it is a dynamic equilibrium. That is to say, there's a constant of 70. If one of the 70 should retire or whatever, or pass on, so then he needs to be replaced. Who will replace him? Or who decides who replaces him? Well, thankfully, you have 69 other qualified existing members of the Sanhedrin who can then choose who the new candidate should be. And no one is more qualified than them to choose. They are existing members of the Sanhedrin. And thus the matter persisted from Moshe's time and as long as the Sanhedrin continued. However, at a certain point, the Sanhedrin was disbanded. This group of 70, where you always had the 69 existing, letting in the 70th newcomer, it was disbanded at the time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. And there was no, for 70 years, there was no Sanhedria Gedola. Now, the Jewish people come back to Eretz Yisrael. You've got to start the Sanhedrin Gedola again. So the question is, who's qualified? Do you have, who is to determine who's qualified? You don't have an existing Sanhedrin to vote in a new member. There is no Sanhedrin. But there's many people that are qualified. Yes, says Rabbi Yehuda Margolius, too many. There were 120 people who were considered to be qualified to be members of the Sanhedrin Gedola. And who's to say to any 50 of them were already full? Well, maybe you shouldn't be full. Maybe I should be there and then you'll be full. Or and someone else should be. So in order to have consensus, anyone who was conceivably qualified was brought in. And that is where the number 120 came from. Because you couldn't choose 70 from them. Kol Dichvin, everyone who was qualified, came in to be part of the Sanhedrin. That's how it became 120. Now, as we'll appreciate, there was no value of maintaining the number of 120. After all, the ideal number, as we know, is 70. But you have to start with 120. It did start with 120. But then what happened? As each member progressively left Sanhedrin through retiring or whatever, they were not replaced. Because we're actually looking to, if you'll pardon the expression, to whittle down the Sanhedrin to its actual correct number, which is 70. Which means that at various points, it went down from 120 all the way down to 70. One point, namely in this whittling down process, when there were 88 members left, was the time when they instituted Purim. And that's why the Yerushalmi says that a Sanhedrin of 88 members instituted Purim. It's not that they got 88 people together for some gematria based on the or Purim or people can work out during the Purim Suda. It's because that's where they were holding in the descent process from 120 to 70. Fascinating explanation of Rebbe Margolius. And he even goes further. We know from Pirkei Avos, where the first Mishnah mentions the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, right? They said three things, Hevet Musun and Badin, etc. What does the next Mishnah say? Shimon HaTzadik Hayom Mishiyori Knesset HaGedola. Shimon HaTzadik was from the remnants of the Knesset HaGedola, and he said his famous three things, the world stands on three things, Torah Avodah, Gemilas HaSadim, says Rebbe Yehuda Margolius. If you know a bit of history, or if you know the historical options, Shimon HaTzadik is close to 200 years after the beginning of the Second Commonwealth. That is called staying power. If he is one of the remainders of the Knesset HaGedola, are we to understand that he was a qualified Dayan at the beginning of the Second Commonwealth and still enduring 200 years later? Rebbe Margolius further suggests that because the Knesset HaGedola was originally 120 people, so when it finally settled at the number 70, that Sanhedrin became known as Shiare Knesset HaGedola, the remainder of the original Knesset HaGedola. It doesn't mean necessarily that you had all of the original members, 70 of the original 120. That's not what we're saying. We're saying is this is the Sanhedrin of 70 that remains over from the original 120. But that name, Shiare Knesset HaGedola, pertained to this remaining Sanhedrin of 70 for generations to come until the name itself faded, which means when 200 years later, Shimon HaTzadik is called, he belongs to the Shiare Knesset HaGedola. It doesn't mean that he was one of the original members. He is a current member of the remaining number of 70 that was whittled down from the 120. So these are fascinating discussions with regards to the Sanhedrin. And again, things with which we're familiar. We know this, that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola 120. Perhaps we never think to wonder why. And certainly a Sanhedrin of 88, you know, Das Daf Men Kenet, and so on and so forth. I'd like to take us back now to the beginning of the parsha. I say take us back. We haven't moved on from there yet. But a very interesting shaila is raised by Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. And again, all of these discussions will give us a deeper insight into what Mishpatim is all about. We have plenty of time to go through Baba Kama, Baba Tzion, and Baba Basra, but to get a sense of what Mishpatim is about. He begins by asking a disarmingly simple question. The concept of Mishpatim, of having a legal system, a judicial system, as far as the Torah is concerned, is not unique to the Jewish people. It happens to be one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Dinim. And now we ask a question. Given that, as far as the Torah is concerned, all nations of the world are enjoined by the Torah to have a judicial system, is there any insistence that they use the system of the Torah called Mishpatim? And the answer, it seems, is no. But the question we need to ask is, why not? After all, we assume, at the risk of oversimplifying, we assume the laws of the Torah are the ideal laws. The Mishpatim of the Torah are the ideal Mishpatim. And if they have a mitzvah of Mishpatim, why not insist that they use the Mishpatim of the Torah? And in fact, the Pasuk makes a point of telling us that they don't, which we say in Psukei Dezimra. Magid Devarav LiYaakov, Chukav Mishpatav LiYisrael. The Mishpatim are for Yisrael, Hashem's Mishpatim. Lo Asachin Chogoy, and he did not do so for other nations. And again, our question is, why not? It's one of their seven, let it be, based on Mishpatim principle. And this ties into another question, which is important to ask. The opening Mishpat of Mishpatim is Eved Ivri, the Hebrew slave or the Hebrew servant. And the question is, why does Parshas Mishpatim open with Eved Ivri? Why was this chosen out of all the mitzvahs to become the opener? And should we ask, or should we counter, well, something has to start, and whatever started, you'd say, why did it start with that? As if to say, to disqualify the question. No, it's a good question. Because as much as you could have started with any mishpat, but Eved Ivri is especially troublesome because it's in the middle of a story. It's in the middle of a mishpat, by which we mean. How does a person come to be an Eved Ivri? He's sold. Why is he sold? Because he stole and was found out and had to pay back, but didn't have the wherewithal. And that's why he sold. That whole background to him being an Eved Ivri is mentioned later on in Parshas Mishpatim. So in other words, we do have a difficult situation on our hands because we haven't even started at the beginning of the Mishpat. At least say, don't steal, and if you steal, you have to pay kefal, double, and if you can't pay kefal, you're sold, and if you buy an Eved Ivri, such and such should happen. So we really seem to have truncated the whole process and started in the middle of a story. And that is the question. Why do we start with Eved Ivri? The answer, says Rabbi Yaakov, again, will take us deeper into the world of Mishpatim. What do we know about Eved Ivri? How long does he serve for? The Pasuk says, for 6 years. And in the seventh year, he goes free. Apparently, even if he hasn't fully paid off his debt, it's capped at 6 years, unless he elects to stay on. Vosepas, 6 years. Where does that number come from? Does that resonate? Does that sound familiar with any other area of Torah? Yes, says the Medrash. Hashem created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. So too, he works for you for 6 years, but he rests on the seventh year. Although you don't bring it back on the Motzei Shabbos year, if you know what I mean. But the parallel is that he works for you for 6 years. It's like Shabbos. But this itself is a fascinating idea. because what's Shabbos got to do with Eved Ivri? This person owes money. He's working off his debt. I'm very happy that the Jewish people keep Shabbos, but you know what? He doesn't have to work on Shabbos. But how does that define his term of service? What do we see from here, says Rabbi Yaakov? That the realm of Mishpatim in Torah is intimately and intricately bound up with all other areas of Torah. There is no segregation. There is no split, as if to say, when we're doing religious laws, so that's things like Shabbos, and then that's that. But when it comes to money, never the twain shall meet. And we don't say that. All of a sudden, no sooner have you bought an Eved Ivri, you've got to remember Hilchos Shabbos, because he's going to work the number of years that you work the number of days. You rest on Shabbos, and so does he. There is a certain fusion. There is a certain wholeness and interconnectedness between the realm of Torah called Mishpatim and other areas of Torah. And now, says Rabbi Yaakov, can we begin to understand why the Torah doesn't insist that non-Jews adopt the Torah's Mishpatim for their judicial system? Why should we? They don't have to keep Shabbos when it's Shabbos. They certainly don't need to keep Shabbos in the laws of Eved Ivri. And we find further, later in the end of Vayikra, but it's all within the world of Eved Ivri, there are terms and conditions, certain types of work that you're not allowed to give to your servant, which are demeaning for him. Why not? Says the Pasuk, Ki avadayim, because all the Jewish people are my servants. Asher otzeisi osam eretz Mitzrayim, I took them out of Egypt. Remember, you were a servant there, and I took you out. He can never be a full servant to you, not to do whatever you want, not if it's demeaning. Which is amazing. 2 minutes ago, we discovered that there's an element of Shabbos within Eved Ivri. We're now discovering there's an element of Pesach in Eved Ivri. And here too, the Torah says, weren't you in Mitzrayim? Shouldn't that change the way, Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, the way that you relate to your own workers? And here again we say, if a non-Jew doesn't have a mitzvah to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim on Seder night, does he need to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim when in his relationship with his servant? In other words, what the mitzvah of Eved Ivri highlights for us is just how wired in the world of Mishpatim is to the world of other types of mitzvahs, including chukim. And that brings us back to the Pasukim Suki Dezim. Magid Devarav LeYaakov, you say Hashem tells his word to Yaakov. Chukav u'mishpatav. The Pasuk mentions in the same breath his statutes and his mishpatim. It mentions them together. Why does it mention them together? Because they are together. It's a package. It's a unified program. The mishpatim don't go by themselves. They're together with the chukim even. There's elements of chukim within mishpatim. And for that reason, lo asachein l'chogoi. He didn't do so for other nations, and even mishpatim ba'yito. They need to have a judicial system that's considered fair. It shouldn't be a travesty. It shouldn't be a laughingstock, and it shouldn't be overly harsh, but it's largely up to them, whatever they do, because the mishpatim of the Torah is part of the body called chukov or mishpatov. If you're in for it all, you're in for mishpatim. Otherwise, do your best. And that is why we may suggest Eved Ivri kicks off the parsha of mishpatim. It begins the parsha of mishpatim, because this nowhere more emphatically, I think, no area of Torah would be less expecting to meet Shabbos and Pesach than the area of Eved Ivri. But it's all wired together. And the same, that sets the tone for Parshas Mishpatim. That's why Eved Ivri comes. I'd like to move from here to a section towards the end of the parsha, much of Mishpatim is, as its name suggests, Mishpatim, the bulk. But in the later sections, it actually deals with a number of other things. And I'd like to move to the end of Perek Kaf Gimel. Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Kaf. What does the pasuk say? Perek kaf gimel pasuk kaf. Hinei anochi sholeach malach lefanecha. Hashem says to Moshe, I am sending an angel before you. Lishmor chabaderech to protect you on the way. Velaviacha al hamakom asher achinos. I'm sending a malach before you to protect you. The Netziv, and of course, in addition to the Netziv wrote many works, his Perush on the Torah is Hamikdavar, but he also has a commentary, his magnum opus really, is his commentary on the She'iltos of Rav Achai called Hamik She'el. And the Netziv asks a very simple question. What is the development in this pasuk? What's happening here? Hashem says to Moshe, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send an angel. He's going to protect you. That is a big development. That's news. Says the Netziv, if no one minds me asking, I'm not quite sure what the big thing is. For the reason why I say this, it's because the pasuk tells us in Tehillim, "Ki malachav yitzabelach lishmocha b'chol derechecha." David HaMelech assures each person, or at least people in general, Hashem will send two malachim to protect you, b'chol derechecha. So we're in a bit of an interesting situation. I don't think we naturally would have put these two together. The pasuk in our parsha and the pasuk in Tehillim in Yoshe B'Seisa Elyon. Here Hashem says to Moshe, you know what? I'm going to send a malach. He's going to protect you. But we're almost asking, well, thank you, but wait, I mean, we already have two. We're doing okay, I think. So how is it such a great occurrence in Moshe's time, but it's actually but twice as much as the norm for all time? That is the very interesting shaila of the Netziv. But looking at these two malachim, that we have this idea, the two malachim accompany a person, what do they do? If you look throughout the Shas, which thankfully the Netziv has done for us, you'll discover all sorts of things that these malachim do, that accompany a person. For example, the Gemara in Maseches Tanis says that they observe a person and they'll testify about his deeds. That's their job, apparently. Do they do anything else? Well, on Shabbos, we know when they accompany him, they bless him and the house is ready for Shabbos. All sorts of jobs are ascribed to these two malachim that accompany a person. They observe, they testify, they accompany, they bless. Says the Netziv, once again, are only trying to ask simple questions. Why is the Gemara ascribing tasks to these two angels when the pasuk has already explicitly stated what their task is? The pasuk says, Ki malachav yitzabelach, for what purpose? Lishmorcha b'chol derechecha, to protect you. It's black on white in the verse. So this puts us in a bit of an awkward situation, because the verse tells us what the task of these malachim is, lishmorcha, and the Gemara is discovering all sorts of other things. It seems everything other than what the pasuk itself said. What are they there for? Says than it seems. It's interesting that the closer we look, and for this reason alone, especially things from the tefillah that we say regularly, to start to pay attention or to pay closer attention, the delicacy and the phraseology. Hashem says he's going to send a malach to protect the Jewish people in our parsha. David says everyone gets two malach to protect them, but it's not the same. What's the verb used from which brings them from Hashem to us? We look at our pasuk, Perek Kaf Gimel, pasuk Kaf. It says, Hinei Anochi Sholeach Malach. I am sending an angel, Lishmorcha Badera, to protect you. The verb used is Sholeach Malach. And the truth is, that is the intuitive term. Even in Parshas Chayei Sarah, when Avram says to Eliezer, Hashem yishlach malacho lefanecha, he will send. That's his shlichut. That's his mission. His mission is to protect you. And now, come back to the pasuk in Tehillim. It doesn't say, ki malachav yishlach lach. It doesn't say that. David never says Hashem will send malachim to protect you. It says, ki malachav yitzavela. He will command malachim to protect you. And that is a very interesting question. What is the difference between yishlach malach and yitzave malach? Says the Netziv, the answer is very simple. If the term used is yishlach, he will send, that means that whatever it's for, that's his shlichut, that's the mission. So if he's sholeach malach lishmorcha baderech, the mission of the malach is to protect you. And that was the situation in our parsha. Hashem was sending a malach whose sole mission was to protect Moshe and the Jewish people. But when it comes to the pasuk in Tehillim, and it says, ki malachav yitzavelach. When you no longer talk about sending a malach to protect the person, but rather telling a malach to protect the person, yitzavelach, it sounds like protection is not the reason why the malach is there. He was nishlach for other reasons. While he's with you, Hashem will tell him to protect you. But protection is not his shlichus. Apparently, he was sent to you for other reasons. What are those other reasons? Says the Netziv, now consult the Gemara. It's to observe, it's to testify. The ongoing presence, the shlichus of the Malach, is for other reasons. But seeing as he's with you, on occasion, Hashem will tell him to protect you. But that's not what he was sent for. And how does the difference come out? Because, says the Netziv, if the whole shlichus of the angel is to protect, then the protection is ongoing, and it could be miraculous, and it could be supernatural, and vouchsafed the whole time. Because that's his shlichus. But that's the situation as it pertained in the wilderness, this supernatural mode of living. Because the Malach was sent for that. But when we look at Lederos, and even as people have Malachim assigned to them, do they have supernatural protection? Rarely, because that's not what the Malachim are there for. On occasion, they'll be told to protect you. But that's a much more low-key event. Not only because it's not their shlichus, it's sporadic, it's contingency based, and moreover, it's much more low key. And look at the next pasuk. What is the pasuk in Tehillim after Ki malachav yitzavelach lishmorcha b'chol derachecha? The following pasuk says, Al kapayim yisa'uncha. They'll carry you. They will carry you. Al kapayim on their hands. Hen tigov b'chol derachecha. lest you strike your foot on a rock. In other words, lest you come to mishap. Says the Netziv, I'd like to ask two questions on this pasuk. And again, the pasuk that we say so often, Al kapayim yisa'uncha. What is the meaning of the word yisa'uncha? Where does it come from? It means to carry. But the word for carry is yisa'ucha. There's no nun. It's yisa'ucha. Like yikarvucha, yirachakucha, yisa'ucha. So what's the nun doing there? I mean, we say it. Does it change the meaning? It does, says the Netziv. And this is a fascinating idea that many Mefarshim discuss. When you have the letter nun in a word, and in the same way, may we say that pronunciation-wise, the nun softens the word, cushions the word a little bit. The presence of an extra nun in the word reflects a diminishing of something. That's what the nun is. A nun at the end of the word, for sure. In fact, there's an idea, I think the Radak even says, the pupil of an eye. What's the Hebrew word for a pupil of an eye? Ishon. Shomreini ki ishon bat ayin. Pupil of an eye is called an ishon. Why is it called an ishon? Says the Radak, because do you know what ishon means? It means little ish, small person. When you look in the pupil of someone's eye, what do you see? A small person. Because if they're looking at you, you see a reflection of yourself in miniature. So you see, you are an ish, hopefully, or isha. What you see reflected is ishon, a diminutive ish. And that's why it's called ishon. And so on and so forth. Coming back to the word yisa'uncha. You know what the nun does in yisa'uncha? It means they'll carry you. But they're not going to carry you in a way which is miraculous. They're not going to carry you high, aloft. It may yet be a very natural thing, but they'll help you get through it. If you're carried aloft over all your problems, that's called yisa'ucha. But if you're carried somewhat, sotto voce, that's called yisa'uncha. And you know how you can tell, says the Netziv, and what a wonderful observation. The pasuk says, al kapayim yisa'uncha. They'll carry you in their hands. Ask the Netziv, whoever carries anyone in their hands? If you carry someone, you carry them in your arms or on your back. You pick someone up and you're taking them for any significant duration. You're not going to be holding them in your hands. When do you pick someone up with your hands? When it's just a momentary thing. Isn't that right? Up and over. But they effectively are doing the walking. They just, there's a rock there. There's something there. They just need to get over it. So the very idea of carrying someone in your hands means it's a very momentary thing. And it's not an extravagant thing. If it's al kapayim carried in your hands, yisa'uncha. And that's why there's a nun there. And this is the difference, says the Netziv, between the malach who was sent to Moshe and malachim that are told to protect people, between carrying in your arms or carrying in your hands. Fascinating interplay between the parsha and the siddur. And if we may just conclude by referring to probably the most of the most famous expressions in our parsha is Na'ase v'nishma. Interestingly, Na'ase v'nishma, which is in Perek Kaf Dalet Pasuk Zayin, is found in Parshas Mishpatim, not in Parshas Yisro. The final Perek of Parshas Mishpatim goes back to Matan Torah. Rashi says it even took place before Matan Torah. That's not a discussion that we're going to get into now. But the first time we see the words Na'ase v'nishma is in Parshas Mishpat. And one thing we know for sure, Na'ase v'nishma, we will do and we will heed or we will listen The order is very specific. It's very important. The question is why? Nishma Banase apparently wouldn't work. We always find Chazal extolling the Jewish people for having mentioned Nase before Nishma. Another feature that relates to Matan Torah, to the giving of the Torah, is the idea of unity amongst the Jewish people. As we know, when we came to Har Sinai, by Yichan Sham Yisrael, Neged Hahar, in the singular, Rashi says, Ishechad, Belevechad. So you have these two ideas. The Jewish people were unified by Yichan Sham Yisrael, and they said Naaseh before Nishma. What is the connection between these two ideas? Unity among the Jewish people and Naaseh before Nishma. Interestingly, someone puts them together, and that's Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. In these Zmiras and Shabbos, some of the Zmiras of Shabbos, they go way back. And the Yonah Matzah Bo Manoach, Yom Shabbos Adei Nishkoch, that's from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, author of the Kuzari. And he says, as we know, Uvo'u Chulam Bivris Yachad, Naaseh V'Nishma Omru Ke'echad. They said Naaseh V'Nishma as one. So the Kuzari, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, he puts together the idea of saying Naaseh V'Nishma as one. But how are they together? So I'd like to preface with a very wonderful idea that I saw. It's in one of the volumes of Rav Shachter on Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. And Rav Soloveitchik, as we know, as Ish Halacha, so he saw ideas. There was no notion of a minag that people stam do. Every minag that's a valid and worthy minag, there's something behind it. And he would endeavor to talk about these things. When it comes to Mevorach Machodesh, and this week, I believe it's Shabbos Mevorachim. So you have the Yehi Ratzon. And then, just before announcing Rosh Chodesh, the Chazan takes the Sefer Torah. Just before Mishal Senisal Abaseinu, he takes the Sefer Torah just before announcing Rosh Chodesh. Why does he hold the Sefer Torah? I mean, it's a good thing to hold the Sefer Torah, but it doesn't happen without reason. He hasn't been holding it until now. Why does he take it at that point? Before we say Mishal Senisal Abaseinu? The answer, says Rosh Soloveitchik, is because the Jewish people need to announce Rosh Chodesh as one, because it's the collective announcement of the Jewish people that bestows, according to some, the status of Rosh Chodesh on the coming Rosh Chodesh. But the Jewish people need to be one unity before announcing Rosh Chodesh. What makes the Jewish people into one? What makes the Jewish people Chaverim Kol Yisrael? The answer is the Sefer Torah. It's an amazing thing. In other words, we're talking, Yehi Ratzon, we should have a good month, it should be full of this, it should be full of that. But now when we get to the point where we need to come together to be announce the Rosh Chodesh, how do you come together? Through the Sefer Torah. So the Chazan takes the Sefer Torah, and through that, Chaverim Kol Yisrael. A very beautiful idea. I'd like to add, actually, and I'd like, how does one add to Rav Soloveitchik? The only way you can add to Rav Soloveitchik is through another Soloveitchik, and that is through his uncle, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk. And they were very close. There was correspondence between Rav Yosef Dov and his uncle Rav Velvel. And Rav Velvel is actually, you see how much attention was paid to the Zmiras, to the Nusach. As we quoted, Uvo'u Kulam Bivris Yachad Naaseh V'Nishma Amru Ke'ech. Why is Naaseh V'Nishma said as one? The difference between these two terms, says Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, Naaseh means the performance of the mitzvah. Nishma is the understanding of the mitzvah. How many different ways are there to understand any given mitzvah? Plenty. Enormous amount, as we know. But there's only one way to perform the mitzvah. The question is, how do you have a plurality of understanding not leading to a plurality of peoples? You know what the answer is? If Naaseh comes before Nishma, then the Jewish people are unified. even as they proceed to explain the mitzvah in so many different ways, if you would envisage or imagine that they said nishma before naase, that means we'll understand and we'll do. So what are you going to do? It depends on how you understand. But how do you understand? Well, if you have 600,000 Jews at Har Sinai, I think you're talking at least as a multiple of 600,000 explanations and opinions. And then how many religions do you have? And how many types of mitzvahs do you have? You could never say nishma v'na'aseh as one. Because if nishma comes before na'aseh, you're all over the place. And there is no unity. But if na'aseh comes first, everyone is committed and everyone is embracing the same practical mitzvah, so then that's a point of departure from which so many different explanations can come. And they all go together now because they're all unified by the practice. Na'aseh v'nishma amru ke'echad. And therefore, just to carry on from Rav Soloveitchik says, the Sefer Torah unites. The Sefer Torah does unite. But the Sefer Torah only unites if Naaseh comes before Nishma. Otherwise, the Sefer Torah itself can fragment and leave people all over the place. Of course, even within the performance of mitzvahs, there's different customs, but those are all variations on the Naaseh. The divergent customs is a very beautiful thing. That's harmony. And together it produces a symphony. If Naaseh comes before Nishma, what you have is a symphony. If Nishma comes before Naaseh, you have a cacophony. And that is a different order altogether. And so, from the beginning of the Parsha, talking generally about Mishpatim, the ethos of Mishpatim, if one may use that term, the goal of Mishpatim, what we learn about Mishpatim from starting the Parsha with Eved Ivri, moving through to what does it mean to have a Malach sent to you, as opposed to a Malach told to do something for you, and finally to Naaseh v'Nishma, we see just the care and devotion to the words of the Zmiras that are rooted in the Rishonim by the Briskers themselves. That surely is inspiration for us to likewise pay attention. Surely the more we do so, the more we will leave Beruchosh Gadol. All the very best. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Rav Bernstein.